Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What is up, everybody? What is up, and welcome to an already feisty edition of the Keeping It 1000 podcast live here. I've got the always feisty George Carl with me. George, that's me throwing it to you.
Oh, and I got to introduce one of the shortest guys in the NBA.
Thought he was going to say something nice.
Kind of one of the weirdest guys. He thinks he looks good all the time, but I think he looks weird all the time. But he's one hell of a strength, conditioning, human performance. Probably the best one I've ever been around. And I really, really admire him for how he has made his career into a millionaire profit somehow. How he took my job offer in Sacramento and turned it into a big time raise.
We're going to hold nothing back here. I love it. Let's go.
Yo, I'm so...
Steve S.
Man, that is the first compliment George has paid me ever in my life. So I'm going to be a regular on the show. George Cole, one of my favorite coaches of all time. And again, I got a compliment. I'm excited. The Sacramento deal, I didn't get a raise. They told me if I went there, they were going to shoot me. So I had to stay in Denver. But I got so much respect for George, one of the all-time most amazing coaches. And I've learned so much being away from it. Ascertaining what he taught me is amazing. And the brilliant thing is every time I see him, I get re-humbled. So I love to see him.
I feel the exact same way. Every 2 weeks, I get re-humbled here.
Oh, handle sarcasm, guys. Come on. You know I love y'all.
I don't want to spoil anything about next week's show, but George Carl, lots of takes on the current Denver Nuggets. But we're not going to get into that today. We're going to do some history here. Steve Hess is – the Nuggets have been around, I think, for 57 years. For 21 of those years, Steve, you were a part of the team in some capacity, mostly, you know, strength and conditioning coach or other titles, but similar role. And so this is a great opportunity. This series, we like to tell the history of the Denver Nuggets. I don't feel enough has been done to tell the history of the team and bring every generation into the fold of previous ones. So I'm excited to kind of walk down memory lane and hear your perspective on it and you know, hear the different iterations of the team and everything. First, I got to tell everybody, we're presented by DraftKings Sportsbook, America's top-rated sportsbook app. Use promo code DNVR. You guys see it right here above my head. Use that promo code whenever you sign up. You can bet with us in our pregame shows on the Denver Nuggets. This is not going to be a Steve Hess biography, per se, where we go back and talk about all this, but it really is going to be your perspective when you were with the Nuggets. So I know there's been some great work done, including by my guy Jake Fisher, who was at the time at Sports Illustrated, about your life and how you arrived in the NBA. But I kind of want to pick it up here. I read that you saw an opening for the job. You're already here in Denver doing training and working out with different people, but how did you wind up with the Denver Nuggets?
So I was the head trainer at Greenwood Athletic Club. And Alan Bristow, the general manager, wanted to hire a part-time strength coach under Skip Allen, or next to Skip Allen, who was the full-time strength coach for the Avs and acting part-time strength coach for the Denver Nuggets. Denver Nuggets had never had a strength coach in that position. So Alan Bristow's like, but we want to upgrade our facilities.
Right.
We want this part-time strength coach to work under you at Greenwood Athletic Club. I'm like, hell no. I told my wife, I'm getting this job. She's like, Steve, you know nothing about basketball. I'll learn. So I called Alan Bristow, Jim Gillen, who was a trainer at the time. That's my guy. And Bill Hanslick every single day. So eventually, I think they just freaking gave in.
All right.
And they said, we're just going to hire this guy. So I worked two jobs. They said the strength and conditioning position for the Nuggets was part-time. It was more like full-time. And I was a head strength coach for Greenwood Athletic Club.
Right.
And again, we would be running pre-draft drills out of Greenwood. Brevin Knight, I remember him there. Tracy McGrady, is unbelievable opportunity. But I knew nothing. You know, the first time we ran a drill, Bill Hanzik says we're going to run it from base to free throw line extended. I'm like, fuck, where's the free throw line? So I got basketball one-on-one, and that was my start. So
I love it.
That's where we started.
What I love about this story, you're not going to remember this one. I'm already going off script here, because back in, I think it was 2003, I was trying to get an internship in the summer from college, get a summer internship with the Nuggets, and you'd given this speech to prospective interns, and I raised my hand and I said, hey, so do you take interns? And you thought for a second, and you go, no. But if you email me a good reason that I should, maybe I'll consider it. I never did. And I regret it to this day, because the story is similar to what you're saying. And it's something I think at 18, 19, most people don't know this. The older you get, it's like, create the opportunity. And if you don't feel like you're ready for it, figure it out. Study. Figure out what the foul line is and go from there.
Yo, my first assistant, Rich, so I didn't have an assistant. And then my guy calls me up and says, you got to meet this dude. Hire him as an intern. He was my first intern. Ended up being my first assistant.
Man.
Ended up being with the Clippers for 11 years. Now he's the head strength coach for the Knicks. Dude's amazing.
There's an alternate universe where I'm his assistant still, a lot more ripped, probably a lot bigger biceps. Probably would have learned a few things.
No, you do not want to be my assistant. Everyone I've had are like, my guy, we fucking hate you. So you don't want that.
George, so if we go back to 1997, what was the state of working out, like with players? What was strength and conditioning like at that time, and when did it really start to become a bigger emphasis in the NBA?
My recollection is, I think it was my second year in Seattle. We played Utah Jazz in the playoffs, and they beat us up. Karl Malone, Mark Eaton, Thurl Bailey. They had another kid, a car kid, I think, from Wichita State, and they just beat us up. And I went home and we talked about it. And at that time, I don't know how many strength and conditioning coaches were in the league. This was like 1993.
Started slow.
93 or 94. And I met with my trainer, Frank Furtado was the trainer at the time. He loved the idea of getting a weight guy, a strength and conditioning guy, a human performance guy. And we hired Bobby Medina out of UNLV, because Tim Gergerich, my assistant, was a UNLV guy, so we hired his guy. And Bobby Medina is still, I think, where is he now, Santa Clara?
Yeah.
He's still in the business, And we had mandatory weight training, and that wasn't accepted very well. I mean, a lot of guys just took the fine and didn't do it.
Really? They would rather fine than do the man. That's crazy to think.
That's probably the early 90s, 93, 94. And where it's gone in 25 years is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a leader of human performance now.
Right, right.
In many, many ways. The analytics of it are driving a lot of people crazy, but it's great information to have. And when I got here, Steve and I, we jerk each other off all day long, but Steve Hess, when I first got here, the thing that was amazing about it was, one, Bistelic had laid a sound foundation to pick up on. And two, Jim Gillen and Steve Hess were top of the class, in my mind, of trainer and strength guy. And I didn't have to worry about any of that. All I had to worry about was basketball, and it was really good.
So when you arrived, Steve, did you feel like you had a blueprint for what they expected of you, or was it, hey, create? We know we don't want our athletes to be at peak performance. Create what that looks like.
So they absolutely did not have a blueprint. And I feel a lot of sports, especially at that time, was all based on football. So the one thing which I feel was an amazing opportunity for me, I could relook at what the athletes needed and come in from a fresh perspective. Jim Gillen was amazing because he didn't micromanage. Even Bill Hanslick, my first year, when we went 11-71,
right.
You know, coaches would be like, on you. They didn't do that. Even guys like Coach Winters, Coach Dunn. And at that time, you got four coaches, myself, Jim, and Max. That's it. We did everything.
Yeah.
So we're making, I remember, EAS milkshakes. I got the blender, making the shakes, doing all that stuff. So it was a lot smaller. Mm-hmm. But I feel like a lot of the things we did, we were right at the top, you know, just like bringing Team Fit and Eat Right and things like that to the NBA. We were doing it. But the brilliant thing about the organization, they had faith in us and they let us do our thing. And that was an amazing opportunity. That being said, we spent a lot of time looking at the physiology, the mechanics, the nutrition of what the basketball players needed.
And were you learning a lot? Do you feel like by, you start 97, 98, part-time, full-time right after that. Do you feel like 2-3 years in, you kind of, okay, we have a process. I know what this is now. Or was it sooner, slower than that? How was it?
See, here's the thing. If I did my 15th year, when I did year one, I remember taking Tony Battea into the weight room and having squat 315 before a game.
Oh, wow.
If I did what I did my first year, I'd be fired. That being said, I learned every single day.
Right, right.
On the job, it was amazing. Watching how these athletes work, listening to the coaches, being away and understanding what I didn't take advantage of. Hugely amazing opportunity. But the thing is, it's evolving the entire time.
Right.
And if you're open-minded, you got a shot. If you're not, you can never, ever stay in the league.
So here's where I want to go. We're going to get to the good years, but when you started, it was the bad years for the Nuggets for a lot. And just to give some people a background, in the late 90s, the ownership group for the Nuggets was sort of in flux. Ascent owned the Nuggets. Liberty Media bought Ascent and then told them to sell it. Ascent sold it to a guy. It got canceled. It didn't work out. Eventually went to the Cronkies. This took several years, and this was the years you first started. Not coincidentally, the Nuggets had the worst record in basketball for those years, quite a bit in a row. Did that ownership stability when you first started out, could you sense it? And could you feel like, okay, this team is maybe in a spot where it didn't have a clear direction they were going?
So initially with Ascent, Charlie Lyons was the CEO. That's my guy.
Okay.
So I trained him. He was progressive in his views, but there wasn't a standardized vision. When Mr. Kroenke came in, unbelievably standard, the vision was like, we want to win a championship. We didn't quite know how, but that's the expectation. Upgraded everything, was always unbelievably amazing to me. Ultimate goal, find a way to win a championship. Now, is he going to spend $500 million? No. He told me 1,000 times, I learned so much from that man, I still do. I will do it being fiscally responsible. I have that opportunity. But are you kidding me? You went from not really knowing where you're at to having an interactive owner who believed in what you were doing and wanted to win a championship. I thought I'd won the lotto.
Really?
So from my perspective, 100% different.
It's interesting to hear that. You don't hear, I mean, the nickname for Stan Kroenke is Silent Stan. He doesn't communicate very much, so nobody really knows what he's thinking. So you rely on sort of these secondhand things. I want to get to some of these early players. The era wasn't great, but some of the players were great. Antonio McDice was there. What was your impressions of him when you got to work with him?
Yo, 44-inch vert, freak of nature. Yeah. That's my guy. You know, as I say, going back to it, you know, I remember going to visit him in the summers and working in my mouth, things like that. I think initially there was a misdirection with him. Had he had come in at a later time, I think it would have been a different story. But Antonio McDice, again, like, he'll come in the summer just playing around with 315. I mean, he's just an unbelievable athlete. Incredible, one of the best athletes I've ever seen in my life.
What do you remember? What's the scouting report you have on Antonio McDice? Is my first favorite nugget, or one of my first favorite nuggets?
I don't really have a good recollection of him other than extremely talented. I remember in the draft, we were evaluating him. We were in Seattle at the time, and we thought we had a chance at him. But I don't know if it was injuries that slowed him down,
right,
or his progress. He had a couple good years.
Yeah.
But yep. I don't think he ever reached his potential. He never got to the athletic ability. And he wasn't a bad basketball player, but he just never got lucky, or
right,
the pieces never came together. It never connected for him. That's my recollection of him.
A string of really tough injuries for him early on in his career. And yeah, like you said, athleticism, such a big part of it. I loved his footwork in the post. Keon Clark was also there. He's also another one. This is one that's kind of gone. I just had to ask about him because, again, this is my era. But he was another guy that really got up. What do you remember about him?
Yo, amazing, amazing second jump. Really explosive. What I remember, I remember Keon, and again, he always had the answers. You know, if his baby toes hurting him, he'd cut a hole in the shoe, and Jim would be like, it's unsafe. He'd be like, no. The one thing about Keon, though, which I do love, and I'm not just saying this, and again, I apologize for my profanities.
Go for it.
But when people say they don't give a fuck, it enables them to maybe find greatness. And he really didn't give a fuck. And I respect that. Mm. He practiced hard, played hard, lifted hard. Did he always buy into my systems? No, not really. Did he buy into my nutrition? No, but I'm okay with that because he did the best that he could at the time, but didn't have the most amazing bond with him, but still respect him and respect his athleticism.
The last guy, and I'll start with you on this one, Coach, because he's an interesting nugget. Rafe LaFrance, a third overall pick. You look at him, it didn't work out for him. Like, he was another guy that Denver came in to be the cornerstone. It didn't work out. What do you think went wrong when you watch his career? And you look at it, he was a 37% three-point shooter. Did he come around too early, do you think?
I was disappointed in Rafe LaFrance because I thought he was going to be really good.
Mm-hmm.
I thought initially his first couple years, everybody, it looked like it was going in a good direction. He actually played with my USA team in the World Games. And that, his, you know, I don't know what Steve would think, but I never coached him in the NBA, but the month or so I coached him in a USA game, it didn't seem he had a passion for the game.
Mm,
it didn't seem like he really enjoyed the court. Being on a USA team, you thought that you would think guys would get excited and fired up to be a part of it. And Rafe was kind of a laid-back dude that just enjoyed what he had and didn't push himself, I think, to get the most out of his skills. And I could be totally wrong. Again, I never coached him in the NBA. Right. I only had him for a month on a USA basketball team.
He certainly didn't play with a ton of fire. What do you remember about Rafe?
I remember Rafe LaFrance, one of my a great friend of mine. Joey's his wife. Again, I think his knowledge of the game is amazing. Footwork's amazing. Ability to shoot's amazing. Could have got more athletic. Sometimes I think he had a love for the game, but he didn't have that that fire, that like Kevin Garnett, like type things. And a lot of times on a long, tedious season, you got to have some of that. It doesn't have to show up like that. Could Rafe have been a franchise player? I believe absolutely. The gifts that he had.
Right.
But I even see it with the Joker. He has that. Like, I remember when he was a rookie, we were playing paintball. He wanted to kill everyone. But he's got that, like, that in him. You don't see it. Yeah. I don't know if Rafe had that. Now, that being said, the gifts and shit like that, unbelievable. And again, an unbelievable friend of mine. So it's kind of a tough situation.
That's interesting. What do you think? If you go back to 1999, it was a lockout year, so it was a weird year. But you had Mike D'Antoni was the head coach, went on to become one of the great coaches of the 2010s. You had Nick Van Exel, Chauncey Billups is there in his second season. You got Antonio McDice, but that at Rafe LaFrance, you had some young talent, but it never got off the ground. If you just look at that 98 to 2003 era, what do you remember about it, and why didn't Denver ever get traction there, in your opinion?
So I think Mike D'Antoni was there for 1 year.
1 year, yep.
And he actually no longer had the ability to do that when we went to the Pepsi Center. I think Mike was, his vision was amazing. I remember distinctly prior to it not going great, we talking about how we were going to structure the specifics of practice as it would simulate games. And I think it may have gone a little bit differently. And it's easy to say, hearsay, it may have gone differently if he had the opportunity to grow the team and spend some time with them, because even that short time I was with him, he was a compassionate, smart coach that could be really beneficial. The issue is with the NBA, you got to kind of win now.
Right.
It's not, and I don't care what anyone says, it's not a feel-good thing, and that may have played into it. I kind of feel like those guys, Nick, look, it's the same with Nick, amazing when the lights on and the popcorn's popping, but doesn't adhere to everything everyone else wants to have him do. So what I feel a lot of times, the coach's direction at that time, you didn't coach the players, you coached the concept. And I think Mike does a really good job of coaching the players.
Let's get into the Melo era here. In 2003, so you go those first few years, I'm sure you're learning things on the fly, teams kind of changing, new ownership, all this different stuff. 2003 feels like the beginning of a new era. I mean, the team changed colors. They changed the rebrand, everything, and then, of course, Carmelo arrives. First question is, were you watching the lottery that year, and was there a buzz about the Nuggets had the best odds to win the lottery in the LeBron-Carmelo year? Were you personally invested in watching the lottery and like, oh, man, what's going to happen?
Are you kidding me? So they had a prototype of the new colors, and I wore that tank top to the draft, and they're like, you got to change. That hasn't been shown to anyone yet. I mean, I really thought we had a chance at LeBron. Right. I don't know much about Melo. And then again, I don't know what would have happened. I mean, when we had Dwayne Wade come work out with us, I'm telling you about my assistant. He used to play with the guys. Dwayne Wade, yo, we're behind his back, Doug. I'm like, my God, we got to take him. Melo's workout, as I say, we didn't kill him. I didn't spend a ton of time watching him play. So I really, like, I'm like, please, like, let's get LeBron. And I really thought we had that shot. And then once we got Melo, and I don't know if we had had the second pick, if we would have taken him. I don't know.
Right.
I'm not going to say we would. I'm just saying, I don't know.
What would your guess be if I told you you had to predict?
Oh, sheesh. I, look,
put
I
you think on the spot here.
Stan may have, may have overridden that decision.
Right. Skinashvili the year before wasn't working out. To go, that's the only thing that makes me wonder.
That's what I'm saying. I think it may. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know. But fuck, that would have been a bad move. So, and then like once Melo rolled in, that dude's a beast.
Yeah. George, what do you remember? The 2003 draft class is an all-timer. What do you remember before, in the lead up to it? Did you have guys you really liked or disliked in that draft?
Oh man, that's I know we were, before I came to Denver, I was in Milwaukee, and we knew Dwayne Wade.
Right. Yep.
And, in 2003, I think I was still in Milwaukee. I don't know when I got fired. Maybe I got fired in 2003.
Might have been.
I think I got fired too much money that summer.
Yeah.
I think I got fired that summer. I was involved with the draft. We took T.J. Ford at 9.
That's right.
And we wanted to get Wade. At I think he went 6 or 5. And we tried to get Wade more than anybody else because we knew he was in Milwaukee. He was in Milwaukee. We knew him. We thought he was going to be special. I know that LeBron, we all knew, was going to be dynamite. But I think that the rumors I heard, Denver was going to take Darko.
Number 2, yeah. I remember that was the story. That was the word on the street.
I mean, that Kiki loved him.
Yeah.
And the scouts convinced him, but I don't know.
The chain reaction, if you take a Serbian center and he busts the way that he did, I wonder if the ripple effect is you never get to Jokic. If you never get here, if there's, I know it's years or decades later, this or that.
No, but the thing is with Jokic, he's a second round pick.
Yeah, it's later.
My guy, that's my dude. I love, that's my guy. But there was no pressure on him at all.
We'll get to him. So just, Nene's also on the team. He had been there for a while. Just give me your impression then of, first we'll start with Carmelo, but also Nene, you first start working with them.
Okay, so my impression of Melo, one of the favorite athletes I've ever worked with. Sometimes George and I would have our discussions about that. Yep, but I'm just telling you, he busted his ass.
You can't kiss everybody.
No. But listen,
you can't Melo, make love to everybody.
No, but Melo, for real, I am telling you, never miss practice.
Yeah.
Never miss games.
Oh my God.
Busted his ass in the weight room. Now, here's the thing. So, and this is the thing where George and I disagree, and I learned this. Melvin Hunt once said to me, Melvin Hunt is chilled. And I'm not chilled. I'm totally hyped. I'm like Russell Westbrook all the time.
Yeah.
And Melvin said to me, you can't have swag which is low-key. Melo got crazy low-key swag.
Okay.
And the shit he did from a rookie all the way on, never missed the playoffs, get triple team, play out of the triple team. The dude is a fucking freak of nature. And when he's out of the league, I'm like, that is bullshit. He is a freak of nature. I love that guy.
George, you almost look like you want to rebuttal this. I mean, like, we kind of know some of your takes on him, but if you have something to add here.
You know, we live in an age of kind of fibbing to the media, lying, not telling total truths. And Hess is politically correct.
Jeez.
You know, he likes to be politically correct. He loves everybody. Everybody works hard.
Well, that's the
problem. It's the head coach's problem. It's not the player's problem.
What about Nene?
So let me just go back.
Oh, sure, okay. Sure.
So no.
You guys fight. I'll referee.
There's something good about Nene. I want to hear this.
So here's the thing. We're in March. Melo's averaging 36 minutes a game.
Yep.
His body fat went from like 19 to 9.
Wow.
So
through the course of the season.
Yeah. I mean, he was like, he got down to 218.
Okay.
The dude was, George comes to me. Yo, this dude is sluggish. You got to run sixes on the side with Melo. I'm like, George, sluggish? He needs a B12 shot, not running sixes. So George is on his ass.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you, Nene, athletic as shit. Do I think he had an intrinsic love for the game of basketball? No. Now, Melo did. So what I'm saying, and this is when George can say whatever you want. There's certain dudes, Melo, JR,
right.
AI, when the fucking game starts, that's all they give a shit about. They live for
right.
it. I don't think Nene lived for it. And what ends up, I think, unbelievably athletic, hugely talented. 2009, we make that run. But that being said, if you're going to roll into the NBA, 9 preseason, 82 regular season, go to the playoffs, you got to have a different mindset. Mm. You got to be a mutant because you are going to be fucked up.
Right.
So if you're worried about anything hurting, it's a wrap.
Right.
So and that comes out of the true love. Now, passionate about so many other things, wasn't in love with basketball.
Mm. Seems like a common thing for bigs. We just talked with Rafe, this or that. I mean, being 7 feet tall, you're self-selected for the NBA a little bit, but not everybody chooses that. So I feel like that's the common theme there. Like, you get more bigs who are less interested in basketball than any other spot.
Well, I think there are going to be more and more bigs like the game because we're letting the bigs go outside more.
Right.
I'll agree that big guys in the old days, in the 1990s and the 2000s, the wrestling matches and the hugging, elbow and asshole game.
Right.
It was real. It was real. It was a fight in many ways. And Nene might be one of the strongest guys I've ever coached.
That's like, he'll grab you. I mean, you're like, dude, he swung on Aloha Candy once when we were playing the Clippers. If he connected, he would have decapitated
him. He was a monster.
Yo, and agile and quick and explosive. My man.
What stood out about that first season? I mean, this is pre-George Karl, that first year, but if he just kind of encapsulated, Nuggets ended up losing to the KG Wolves that year in the first round, but what do you remember about that first Melo year?
Firstly, my man Jeff Bistelic, I got so much respect for him.
Yeah.
Blue collar, hard working, we're all in this together. Shirts tucked in, you have practice with the ball, it goes out, you just hard working, and he created that culture. We don't go to the playoffs without Melo.
Right.
So what as my first year in the playoffs, I'm freaking ecstatic. The whole thing just, it was just an amazing, amazing thing. I remember Michael Jordan came one of the games and wanted to speak to Melo, and I'm just like, this is Melo's time. It was like,
right.
It was just the most amazing thing. I mean, you've been there 7 years before you go to the playoffs. That shit was amazing.
So the next year, so the team had added pieces. Marcus Camby arrived before Melo 1 year. Andre Miller arrived with Carmelo. The next year you get Kenyon Martin, so you're not only adding Melo and you have Nene coming along, but you're starting to add veteran guys who can help get you over the hump. So you add Kenyon. Coach Bezdelic was let go that next year, and Cooper took over for a little bit, and then ultimately George arrived. I'll go to you on this one first, but just what was it like when George arrived? The team ended up finishing on a really big hot streak to finish the year, but what do you remember about when he arrived?
Man, I remember distinctly. Like, I was depressed at that point. We got our asses kicked by Detroit, and we're going to Indiana. They tell me, like, George is coming.
I'm Milwaukee.
We play Milwaukee first?
Oh, wow. Of course he's going to remember that detail.
So do we beat Milwaukee?
Down 10 in the fourth.
So we beat Milwaukee, then we go to Indiana, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing, we always got our asses kicked in Milwaukee and Indiana. So we win Milwaukee, so I think this dude's legit. Then we go to Indiana, we're getting our ass kicked, we're coming at the half, and he simply says, pick up the corners in the paint, that's all you guys got to do, and we'll win this game. We beat Indiana, I'm like, hell yeah, this is going to be amazing. Little did I know, he was going to kick my ass for 3 years, but here's the thing, you did have hope. And every year, you're like, we could win a championship. And here's the thing, and again, I'm not blowing him, I'm not being politically correct. As a basketball savant, the dude is a fucking genius. As socially, politically correct, a total ass. And 9 out of 10 people would be the biggest ass. But when it comes to fucking basketball, the dude is a freak.
Did you know that about him, though, before he arrived? Was that the reputation? Like, hey, this is a guy that's going to tell it like it is.
So here's the thing. 90% of the information I got about everyone until I met him never turned out being
good
that.
Rule.
So my thing is with George, here's what I know. He absolutely, unequivocally lived for the game. And if he didn't like something, he's going to say it, and it'd be real and not politically correct. And if you had a feeling, you may want to lose your feeling. And if you had thin skin like I did, good fucking luck. But that being said, when it came to it didn't matter what game and how much you were down, you always had hope.
Coach, this is the first time we've talked about your arrival with the Denver Nuggets and any of the shows we've done. What was your mind frame and like what? How much did you have a game plan in place when you arrived versus you just showed up and said, let me learn what's going on with this team?
I thought the team was underachieving. You know, I had some conversations with Denver right after Bastelli got let go. And, you know, we were talking, and I told him I thought they were a playoff team. And so when I got here, that was the theme, that we're underachieving, we're not playing up to our level of talent, and it's our job to change that. The things I remember were we had a pretty good coaching staff, but it was divided. And I remember we played the last game before the All-Star break was in Charlotte. And I made the decision I had to get Doug Moe on the bench. I had to get Doug Moe back, because my evaluation of the organization was Doug Moe got along with everybody. Doug Moe was kind of the funny guy that everybody liked to be around. And our organization was kind of apart, and we had to bring it together. And Doug Moe was one, putting him back on the bench. And I want you to know, Doug did not want to go on the bench. And Big Jane didn't want Doug to go on the bench. But I asked him, and I said, Doug, you don't have to do anything except be my friend.
Right.
And be hard on me when I need to be handled hard. And Doug is just a personality, but a competitive son of a bitch.
Right.
I mean, Doug doesn't like losing. He wants to win every game. And I thought that was a unifying factor. I think at the end of the year is when we got Gerg, right?
Yep.
At the end of the year, we got Gerg, and then maybe the next year, we got John Welsh. And so we had our player development totally under control. But I, you know, the run we went on was amazing.
Well, I want to talk about that.
I think I won Coach of the Month 4 months in a row.
To end the year?
Does that happen? I mean, we just had kept going. I think I don't know what our record was, but we very seldom lost at home, and that was a big thing of not only myself but Doug and Kiki, that the home court we got to take advantage of it. And then the other key to the game that I know all my Andre Miller haters out there will hate this comment, but Andre Miller was so good for a coach to come in and take over a team, because he coached, you know, Andre Miller could have coached a team. That's how basketball IQ and savvy he has.
Toughness, I imagine, is important at that too, to get to be heard.
But Andre Miller would call plays I never even heard of. I'm sitting on the bench, and he'd call a play. I go, "What's that? What are we going to do?" But
he had a secret playbook.
I mean, there were some things that came together. And I remember winning the first game in the playoffs against San Antonio, and then I remember game three.
We'll get there. Let me hold on this. Just how quickly did you feel things were different when?
So first thing, didn't go back to Andre Miller. Yo, people under the misconception, he's one of the best athletes in the first three steps ever. Toughness, I'm gonna tell you toughness. This dude tears his rotator cuff, full thickness tear, and then plays the next game.
Right.
The toughest cat on the planet. He is a straight up hummer. How I'm just telling you, when George came in, we were the thuggets. He created a family among the coaches with 2:47 on the clock. Us did it twice. I'm like, fuck that. They beating the shit out of each other. Each game, we were like, yo, we were so fired up. Like, we all wanted to fight. I mean, it's like, that's the thing I miss.
It's
like
blood.
That was the thing. Now, let me tell you though, you lost. Man, you want to shoot yourself.
No, it came back at you. Oh, it started being pointed that way.
It's like, and listen, if he's in a bad mood, it's a fucking 2-hour practice. And he'll stand in the corner, and it's going. But that being said, like, you had this concept. You could win every game. And when you lost, you're like, I don't want to fucking lose again.
So George says whenever he'd get mad at Melo, he'd have to yell at somebody else what he wanted to yell at Yellow. So he'd yell at Anthony Carter to get back on defense better, but really he's saying this. Was it the same for coaches? Was he yelling at you
George, the one thing is, he's asked me in the first 3 years, I'm going to tell you again, I don't know how I didn't quit. That being said, never micromanage me. And Gergs is to this day one of my favorite people on the planet. This is one of the most unbelievable basketball coaches, savant. John Welsh, one of the best player development, but we're not playing. guys are coming in, they're getting better,
right.
But we're not playing. And George put this all together, and as I say, we were in it.
Yeah.
We were in it to win it.
So I remember this playoff run. That's why I wanted to stop you. The Nuggets win game one on the road against right. the Spurs. Spurs go on to win the title. This one, spoiler alert here, but they go on to win the title. This is 2005. Get blown out in game two on the road, kind of as expected, I guess. But you come back, it's a close loss in game three. In game four, I was at. It was an overtime loss, and Tony Parker just caught fire in the fourth in an overtime. I thought Denver, I think everybody in that arena thought Denver had that one, and you blow, and the team blows it. Then game five, you know, you lose, you end up losing in five. They go on to win the title. What do you think the team needed to learn in that series? What was the lesson from that one? The first year of the Melo era, they get blown out by the Wolves. Whatever, this one felt more like a springboard to me, at least.
I just thought I was disappointed that we didn't make it a longer series, because I think you learn things every game you learn a little bit more about what you need to do and what you can't do. And so I was disappointed in go six or seven, but I think as a team we realized that San Antonio being the best,
right,
we were not that far away. So when I joined the team in January, they were seven games, I think, out of the playoffs. And so now, within 3 or 4 months, we're playing a team that won the championship. And so I thought it was on us as a team to get better, to come together. It's on the management to find maybe another piece or two to put it together. And the coaching staff was into getting better. How do we get stronger, better, tougher, smarter? And it was a great – I mean, we were disappointed at how we finished the San Antonio series. The two home games, we could have won.
Right.
Very easily.
Oh, so they're both so close.
Could have won both, and we could have been up 3-1.
By the way, do you remember the scores in these games?
They're low hundreds.
No. 78 to 84. 81 to 86. These were grinded out slugfests that you were seeing in that series the whole way through. In fact, I think there were, out of the five game series, I think only 100 was only scored once or twice.
Well, San Antonio they were into slowing the game down at that time. They were much more into a possession game.
All time defensive players.
They evolved into a faster team later on.
Right.
But they were definitely, they controlled the tempo. And you know, I think Melo, being a young player, I thought learned a lot in that series about being the difference between a regular season and a playoff game.
Right, right.
And I think San Antonio showed their pedigree, showed their character, showed that they're a soulful team the way they came back
right.
and kicked our butts in game two and then, of course, taking the series.
Do you remember, Steve, did that playoff run feel different than the first playoff run?
So, like, again, I'm going to reiterate it. The first playoff run, I felt we were just lucky to be there.
Right, right.
The second playoff run, like when we lost the series, I'm in tears because I really believed, I didn't kind of think, I believed we were going to win. So what I'm saying is it's a different belief system.
Right.
So it totally feels different. I'm just happy to be the first one.
Right.
And the second one is like, I really believe we're going to win it.
By the way, I felt that way as a fan, you know, watching it in 2003. It was like, oh, sweet, we get to be in one round of the playoffs, whereas the next one, games three, games four especially, I was like, hey, man, they got them. They're just as good as this team is, and it felt a lot different. Let's take a quick break. Then I want to come back. We're going to get into Iverson. We're going to get into Chauncey. We're going to get into all of this. But we got to shout out our sponsor, DraftKings Sportsbook, America's top-rated sportsbook app, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. New customers right now can bet just $1. And if your team scores a single point in Sunday's games, you win $100 in free bets. DraftKings Sportsbook customers also get skin in the game with same-game parlays. We do this for almost every single Nuggets game. You can put Jokic points and parlay it with the Nuggets win. Almost always works. Don't listen to what George Karl tells you. It happens more often than not. The Nuggets win this year. Jokic plays great this year. DraftKings is safe, secure, and reliable. Best of all.
I'm not down on Jokic.
That's what you said. That's what I heard. I heard you said you're down. You said he's no good, man. I can't believe it.
Oh, my God. I'm down on some other things, but I'm not down on Jokic.
DraftKings, safe, secure, and reliable. Best of all, you can deposit and withdraw your cash whenever you want. So download the top-rated sportsbook app right now and get that deal. $1 if your team scores, you win $100 in free bets. Must be 21 or older. Colorado only. New restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. And if you have a gambling problem, call 1-800-522-4700. So you follow up. That's your you get half a season. I think the team was 38-12 to go to your belief about beating that team. I mean, of course you did. You were winning almost every single night for the back half of the entire season. The next year, though, seemed like a bit of a letdown almost in some ways, because you only win 44 games, you know, and then end up losing to the Clippers that year. What do you remember about your first full year with the Nuggets, Coach?
We couldn't shoot. We can't shoot the ball. We couldn't make the three. More double teams, more crowded. The paint got crowded to the point where people controlled us. You know, I don't think it was probably the most disappointing year I felt in my time here in Denver. Was we thought we'd be a better team than that. And we kind of never got into that hot period of in a good flow or good rhythm. And be honest with you, I try to forget those years. You know? I remember in the playoffs, we were so bad from the three-point line. It was just like the world, it was saying, we need a shooter. And then we draft Julius Hodge. And
right, yeah.
Who's the worst shooter I've ever coached here in Denver.
Yeah.
So I was confused by that, but we got Clies in that draft,
right.
I think. And he turned out to be a really good find. I think there was someone else in that draft we had a good run with.
I don't remember who the other player was. I have Clies in here as my guy. What do you remember about that season, the first full season with George?
You know, it's like I just remember the playoff series. I remember the disappointment in that because I kind of felt in that playoff series, up until that point, you're kind of in a cloud when you can't be beaten.
Right.
And you honestly feel like you're immortal. And this was the first time, like, I remember sitting on the ground at one of the shoot-arounds, I think, we are mortal. I mean, I don't know if we're going to get out of this. And I'm pretty positive and pretty optimistic. But it was the first time I felt like, I don't know if we're going to beat these guys. And that's from my perspective. And then a lot of times, like, I felt the guys weren't pulling together necessarily. Like, even, like, Gergs and I would have some issues with some of the players, and they just go freaking nuts. And I'm like, it's too soon to go freaking nuts.
Right.
So just that was a little bit, like, as I say, I mean, I had done it so long, still excited to be in the playoff, but that was one where I'm like, I think we're fucked.
And the Clippers were a good team that year.
Yeah.
The Clippers
weren't
very good, but that was
that one
year,
year
that they were a damn good basketball team.
So the next year is the Iverson year, and of course the story here is Melo gets into the brawl at the it was funny, man. When Jokic got suspended the other day, I famously said 5 games. I think he's going to get 5 games when I saw it live. And the reason I said that is because I always remember the Melo gets 15 games for that altercation. Of course, different commissioner, different time, this or that. But Melo gets thrown out. George, did that speed up the process of getting Iverson? Were there talks? And then it was like, hey, we need to go now because we're not going to have Melo for 15 games. You not remember?
I thought the brawl was like in January.
I thought that this happened, and then
Iverson,
it was right after.
Iverson, we picked up in November.
Okay, so I'm out of order on my timeline here.
Yeah.
Really?
We got Iverson.
Do you remember
we were
this?
Like 1-2.
No, we got Iverson after the brawl.
Afterwards.
That's when we traded Andre.
Okay.
And we got Iverson. So I'm pretty sure it was off the brawl, and I do think the whole system was speeding
okay,
up.
Okay, because
I
don't think AI Chauncey trade was in.
Yeah,
race.
Yeah, you're right. Because what I think happened was there was a delayed sort of gratification for Nuggets fans because Iverson played a bunch of games before Melo returned, so you had to sort of wait for that. But either way, so let me ask. I'm going to go to Steve on this one. Just Allen Iverson, what were your first impressions of him? Always hear one of the greatest athletes, pound for pound, of all time. What were some of your early impressions?
So I'll give you a story. I said to him the one time, we were running speed and conditioning drills. I said, my guy, you're one of the best athletes I've ever seen. He says to me, one of? So, and then the other thing about AI, same thing. Everyone tell me, he doesn't lift, doesn't do this. Never missed a lift. Now,
really?
Were the issues? Never missed a lift. Mm. 3 times a week, locked in. Were there ever issues? Hell yeah. But what I'm saying about him, he a warrior, man. He breaks his finger, next day he plays.
Right.
The things like we're in Utah and I'm stretching up Melo and I'm like, yo, franchise, come over here. AI will say to me, franchise, Steve, how many guys does it take to win a game? 5. Shut the fuck up. There ain't one franchise. So again, an unbelievable, listen, this dude is magical. I remember when he's with Philly and one of my guys is his boy and they come to play us. I'm like, please go get him lit. So they went out that night. He went to bed 7 o'clock, came in and still scored 40 on
really?
Us. So he's like the cool thing about what I get to do. The dudes that want to fucking play basketball, that excites me. And then watching him, the dude is unbelievable.
Yeah. What about J.R. Smith? He also arrives that year. Another great athlete.
Now, J.R. is one of the best athletes I've ever seen in my life. Once again, and I'm going to say this for George because I know he's going to be like, are you kidding me? J.R. Smith is a straight-up lion. And he's not a cat and he can't be trained. He is a lion. My dude is a lion. So let him do lion things. Now, are there consequences? Hell yeah.
Right.
But can he ball? Hell yeah. Would I want to coach him? No. Would I want to be a strength coach? Absolutely. Do I want him on a good night? All day. Do I want him on a bad night? Hell no. But that's the cool thing about being a strength coach, George.
Was he a lion, George?
That's a good comparison. I like that. I like that a little
not
bit.
A house, not a house cat.
You're not going to be able to train him. You're not going to.
Yeah.
I mean, JR did really well for us, I thought. I just thought the playoffs got, the stress of the playoffs, I think, it never worked in the playoffs. Mm. But I really admire JR for what he did with his talents. An explosive guy off the bench is something I love to have in my personality. And we had that because of JR Smith many, many times. The one thing about the AI trade that I remember that it was held up a little bit because I didn't want to trade Andre.
Mm, right.
I wanted to keep Andre.
You were right about that.
Because I thought Andre and AI would have worked a lot better than Anthony Carter than AI. But I thought that was the one thing, again, the basketball savvy and IQ of Andre is pretty important to a team that's trying to become a championship team. And then I think the AI mellow experience that we thought could work or might work, it worked a little bit. And instead of going to the positive of working better, as it wore on, it kind of wore out a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think players were understanding that it was difficult to find shots.
Right.
With the two guys that want to shoot it 20 times a game. And so it created a little bit of a negative energy on our basketball
team. Short-lived. It was basically two seasons. I know it spanned three, but it was basically two. That next year, you win 50 games and we're an 8 seed. It was one of the all-time tough top of the West
and
years ever.
And had to make a hell of a run.
Because I think, the 9 seed was 48 wins. So you think about that. 48 wins and up is nine teams is pretty wild. That team, you mentioned the Thuggets earlier in 2004. That was the year where people usually would refer to it. But to me, that's the most popular Nuggets team of my lifetime. Did you feel when Iverson arrived and J.R. Smith's on the scene and Kenyon and Melo, and did you feel like that was when the fan base was most invested, at least up until that point?
Well, when we went to the Western Conference Finals, and that was 2009.
That was after that, yeah.
Yeah, so that's when it was like every single game was packed. Mm. Maybe people driving by my house and honking. So, but this over here was like, it was a different show. I mean, you were like proud to be associated, every aspect of it. So, and we were bad, man. It's like, we could take on any team, I think on or off the court.
Right.
It's like even to the point. So that is like when, from that period on, you're just blessed to be part of this unbelievable organization. They weren't going to take any shit.
Right. Iverson, all-time just cool guy. I mean, I think everybody, whatever you think about him, everybody looks at him as like, hey, man, that's a celebrity right there. And that's why I think the team was so popular.
Yeah, but here's the thing with AI, too. And this is why people, if you don't know him, keep your opinions to yourself. If his car was in the shop, I take him back from the airport, I got a Jeep with a soft top. The dude is so like, oh, hell yeah. I mean, so everyone's got these. Until you know these guys and you spend time with them when it's tough, is it perfect? Absolutely not. But you can't have an opinion on him and just you spend a ton of time with them. And that kills me. Like, oh, I know Kobe. I saw him in an interview. God bless him. No, you don't.
Right.
You don't know him.
So what about Iverson there? It's that like, what is it about him that you feel is
killer,
most?
Yo, killer instinct. Oh. So we're playing. This is when Big Fella was with Houston. AI takes it into the hole three times and gets swatted. I'm like looking like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
He goes in, scores on the fourth time, he comes to the bench. I'm like, my guy, are you nuts? He's like, I just saw the one time and it went in, didn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm like, he is a different human
wired
being.
Wired that way, yeah. All right, the Chauncey trade, Coach Carl has said that he knew within days that this was a team now, that Chauncey was a piece that really brought things together. Do you feel the same way?
100%. Chauncey is a leader. He leads by example. He's tactical. So unlike George, he doesn't hurt people's feelings. So he empowers them.
Oh, yeah. He has a tact. He has a tact to him.
So what I'm saying with, you know, you got George, and as I said, the one thing I'm getting, I'm going to go back to George, puts together a coaching staff that enhances what George is trying to do. Then you bring a guy like this, who the town loves. He pulls the guys together. He's a tough dude. I'm like, yo, this is the guy. With Melo and with Coach. So I think the two, you know, you got George, Melo, and Chauncey, and then possibly additionally Kiki, and then definitely Stan on the ownership. They changed what the Denver Nuggets look like.
Mm. Interesting. We go to that playoff series. It dominated the Hornets. I mean, that series, 4-1, but game four, that was the biggest blowout in NBA playoff history.
Best basketball game I've ever seen.
That shit was so bad. When we played the Hornets, I go to shoot around. I loaded the rack with 405. Their strength coach says to me before the game, who does 405 on your team? I'm like, everybody.
What is 405?
405 pounds on the bench.
Yeah.
Like, no one did it. But I loaded it up. He's like, Hess, you're bullshitting. I'm like, oh, my God. And we do a pregame.
I love it. So I have to imagine that playoff felt different. I mean, you're now in the playoffs. This is, I think, six, seven years. I have to do the math here. 6 years.
My God, you're asking me?
Yeah.
That shit was like, I just died and went to heaven. That is the coolest shit ever. You go and spank another team with your guys who put in all this hard work. That first series, unbelievable. Then you hit them. You go to the Mavs. Oh, man, dude, unbelievable.
The Mavs was a route, too. I mean, it was 4-1. There wasn't a 50-point win in there, but it was the same thing where every game, the better team, it was very clear where the better team was.
I remember Kenyon and Cuban going at it.
Yeah.
I mean, these are my dogs. This was like, we beat them in the final series. My family's over there. They're like clapping like I did some shit.
Yeah.
But to be a part of that was just magical.
We rewatched that whole series. When the pandemic hit, we had to find things to do. So we rewatched that whole series with our audience. And one of the first plays of the first game is Kenyon just chucks Dirk Nowitzki. And it was a kind of a cheap shot. I mean, honestly, he comes through and he just shoves him to the ground and he gets a foul. And it was just one of those ones where it was like, hey, it was so clear he was sending a message. But also, the message was received. Like, that team kind of was looking at him like, oh, man.
I really like that matchup, Dirk and Kenyon, because Kenyon wanted for us, but Dirk still was a pretty damn good player.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't have a bad series, but we had control of him in the series. And Jason Terry hadn't jumped into the game plan like he did a couple years later.
So if you're confident when you're dominating the Hornets, you're confident when you're dominating the Mavs, what were your impressions going up against Kobe and the Lakers? Before the series began, what were you thinking?
So the only thing that freaks me out is Kobe.
Yeah.
Because he's an assassin.
Yeah.
And I respect him so much. And when people say, you know, he does this and this, I've seen him do this and this. Like, he'd be in my gym at Forza after hours, stuff on the courts. I know that scared me, but I thought we would kill him.
Mm.
And I'm like, honest to God, I thought we were going to win a championship. I nearly did a Bobby Medina's. And I know he's going to know what I'm talking about. I nearly spent the playoff check before I got it.
I love that. 2010 season. We got to hurry along because I know we're running out of time here. But 2010 season, it's a 35-18 start. Did you feel that year that it was run it back, we got another chance, we're even better this year? What was your impression before news came out that George Karl is going to have to step away?
Like, that was, I really feel like, and then we played Utah that year, right, in the first round?
Yeah,
So, as I say, that's our leader. Like, once he's out, I'm like, we're fucked.
You kind of help.
Just, it's not only, it's like, I hate to say this, and fuck, if he was my dad, I'd probably shoot myself, but it was like your father, or the father figure of the whole thing was out. So there's a letdown. Even when he was sick on a practice, everyone would be like, hell yeah. Even me, I'd be like, no one looking over my shoulder.
Yeah.
No one's going to be like, Hess, what's going on? But you knew he held you accountable. So right then, I'm like, we got too many dudes that we got to hold each other accountable. So I knew, I just like knew we were fucked.
If we go to the melodrama, kind of going around. Obviously, that season it ends 4-2. The Nuggets were the third best offense. I think the number one record. You know, Coach Karl is the coach of the All Star game, and then steps away, and it just kind of fell apart as you mentioned there, and they end up losing. The melodrama is the next year. But before we get to that, Ty Lawson's a fan favorite. He arrives that next year as well. Coach, I'll start with you on this one. What were your first impressions? It is a veteran team at this point, but what were your impressions of Ty Lawson as a player?
we had Ty Lawson in the top five of that draft.
Mm.
As a scouting.
How much is that your Tar Heel bias?
I don't get involved with the draft.
Okay.
I mean, I got involved with, they wanted me to find out the real story about what Ty was doing back in Chapel Hill. But I very seldom study college basketball and draft. I watch the workouts. I shake hands. I take them to lunch. I go to dinner with them.
But when you get them in and you start working with them?
Ty took care of, anytime Ty is on the basketball court playing basketball, he does impressive things. And I think the veterans picked up on Ty very quickly. I remember like a week into workouts before we started practice, Kenyon Martin come to me and said, "Coach, you got to play this guy. You're going to have to play this guy."
Mm.
And, you know, he proved us right. And then the next thing we were thinking was, you know, Ty and Chauncey together will work.
Right.
And fortunately, we didn't play a lot that year together. But then when we made the trade, we would play Felton.
Right, right.
Raymond Felton and him together, which worked out to be tremendous. And then we turned Raymond Felton back into Andre Miller. And, you know, after the Melo trade, I thought we sustained being a good team and got a little bit better every year after that.
And I doubt he would show up as your best athletes list, but Ty Lawson was probably one of the fastest guys you worked with.
He's an athlete.
Really?
So now here's the other thing too, though, and this is where people get. So I think Georgia's run and gun, and that whole speed thing, and then you got some really amazing bigs, open lanes for Ty, so it allows him to do what he wants to do. But I don't think he's as successful as he is without the system that George had.
Mm.
But in that system, watching that cat move, he's unbelievable.
Yeah,
I think he might be faster with the ball than without the ball.
100%.
So I know you. So Gallo comes over, Wilson Chandler comes over, Mozgov. I know Gallo still works out with you quite a bit. What were your first impressions? And, you know, is he a guy that you've bonded with and sort of kept in touch with, especially?
He went to Italy every year, free of charge, first class.
That's why I did it, to go to Italy every year. So, and then the one year George came with me, he books his ticket last minute.
Yeah.
He's sitting in the middle with two fat guys. He goes, "Hess, come sit over here." Holy shit.
Wow.
Oh my God, dog.
Come on.
And then listen, so I got to tell you this, and then I'll go quick. We rent a car. So George would go watch Kobe shoot around. Then we'll go to Gallo. So it's like 18-hour days for me and John.
Yeah.
So George would make me drive to Gallo's place, and the fucker would go to sleep. So they had this thing on the car that if you exceeded the speed, it would go beep, beep, beep. You fall asleep, I go over there and go beep, beep, beep. It's like, what's that? I don't know. So Gallo's be my, like, Gallo's family.
Yeah.
So I train him every year. We had that bond all the way through. Same with Wilson. I used to call Wilson my son. So Gallo and I have always had an amazing bond.
Where does that 2013 season rank? And you kind of look at all your time with the Nuggets. Is that
when Gallo got hurt?
No, that was the – well, yes. It's the 57-win season.
Okay.
Gallo gets hurt.
So we went on a 15-game winning streak. George calls me in the office. What do you think? I'm like, this is the coolest shit ever. We run dudes out of the gym in quarter one. They'd be on the side sucking oxygen. Man, they didn't even want to come into our facility. We would just run them out of here.
Yeah.
And that's when you're looking at that whole run and gun thing. We were so badass.
Yeah.
He doesn't get injured. And people forget, Manimal had a huge ankle sprain. So he's coming off an ankle sprain. Gallo doesn't get different. And I'll tell you something else.
Freed missed the first two games.
Yeah, Freed missed
the
games.
So here's the thing. I don't think Golden State, because that's when Big Fella hurt his groin.
Yep.
So I don't think Golden State becomes Golden State without that happening to us.
Yep.
So that was like, that was, but fuck, we were good. We were so good. Oh my, you were lucky to beat us.
Yeah, especially in Denver, man, that year. We got to speed through here. We're going to skip some of the 2013 to 16 era, but you did catch a couple years with Nikola Jokic, Michael Malone, and some of the new faces, Will Barton. What was your first impression of Nikola Jokic when you met him? And when did you first hear that this is a guy?
So we drafted Nikola and
Nurk.
So we came in, we spoke to that. We had a rookie transition. Jameer Nelson hooked it up in Philadelphia.
I remember.
Myself and Dan were the only two who were there. The Joker was there. That's what I'm telling you. My guy, him and Wilson are on my team. We killed Jameer. And I'm telling you, this dude was an assassin. Here's the thing about the Joker.
At paintball.
Killed him.
We have a theory, because we know he played spike ball one time as a team, and he dominated that as well. I think he might just be good at everything that involves hand-eye coordination.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Because he's passionate about it, there's no fucking drama.
Yeah.
See, here's the thing about him. This dude is the most humble, unbelievably wonderful person I've ever met off the court. On the court, he's a killer.
Yeah.
And people don't see that shit. So he asked me about him. Again, he lost like 40 pounds the first year. Do whatever you asked him to do. Tough as shit, but just unbelievable. He don't care what he's wearing, what he's driving, none of that. Just basketball. Just a solid human being.
What do people maybe not know about? I mean, that part, you know, you hear that from everybody, even players that come through this or that. You know, just working with him. I guess I would ask you this. Did you know early on that he was a future MVP caliber player?
So here's the thing. He went to Gerg's rookie camp. Gerg's called me up. He said, you better take care of this guy. This dude is going to be unbelievable.
Really?
Swear to God.
Okay.
Gerg's called me up. I called Tim Connolly up after the paintball game. I'm like, this dude is going to be an all-star. Tim's like, you watch him play? I'm like, hell no. We fucking dominated paintball. Then Gerg's hits me up. You better take care of this dude or I'm going to kick your ass. He is going to be fantastic.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love it. And then Will Barton. I know Murray was like, you were barely around him. I think maybe spent one season. I don't know if you have any.
Two? Murray?
Two, oh, two.
Bilateral abdominal tears. Dude played 82 games. One of the toughest individuals on the planet. Mm. No drama. Just, again, a solid, tough guy. Love Murray. Will Barton, that's my dude. We still do a little bit of stuff right now. Again, always underestimated, rises above it.
Right.
Doesn't read the negative press.
Right.
Solid human being.
I love it. We went a little bit long. Let me give you a rapid-fire list here because I know people will get mad if I don't ask these ones. First of all, just what's your relationship with the team now? And, like, how much are you talking to guys? And sort of what would you say the status is of that?
So, I mean, I talk to guys like you would friends. Felipe does an amazing job. I think they do an amazing job. I'm not locked in. I'm director of my own facility, Panorama Wellness and Sports Institute. But I'm locked in. I'm working 17-hour days. So when people say, like, one more, a lot of times I don't even have the ability to watch games. Blessed in what I do, but again, love the Nuggets, will die a Nugget fan and part of it, but we all get on with our lives.
Right. Hardest workers you've worked with in Denver?
Anthony Carter.
Really?
Dude would irritate me. On the road, Sheldon Williams. On the road, 8 a.m. we lifted. We got in at 4, I get a call, let's go. I'm like,
really?
I'm
gonna stab this dude.
And here's the crazy thing. He worked my son out and Devin. Devin's going to be in the NBA. Anthony Carter, hands down, hardest worker.
I love that, man. What about best athletes?
J.R. Smith, Nate, McDice.
I love it. And then last one, what is
Nate?
Nate Robinson.
And you could chime in on this one, too. What do you think is the most common flaw you see from NBA players in terms of their approach?
Mental weakness. Thinking at some point it's going to get easy. Thinking when they make $100 million, it'll
get never easy.
If you understand, you just take hard as a concept and know it's always going to be hard. You got a shot. But if you get softened by the money, no shot.
Steve, this was great. This was a fantastic hour. I actually kept you late 3 minutes, and I really appreciate it. Oh, Allie, you have something for me?
I have a super chat.
Sure. Read it real quickly. Too Tall Tucker, I see. Somebody says, who are some of the greatest non-traditional athletes that you've worked with? Example for Jokic's coordination. So usually we think athleticism, strength, fast, this or that. But is there guys – Jokic's just – his hands are unbelievable. It's like a robot. He doesn't miss anything.
The other thing about Jokic, which I love, plays at a different pace. So if you look at it, it's an off pace. So it's hard to guard because he doesn't do what everyone else does.
Right.
We all seem to like follow someone else's game or do this. He doesn't. It throws you off.
Yeah.
The other thing about Jokic, because he's so passionate about the game, he's locked in.
Yeah.
So when people are like, oh, wait till the fourth quarter, he don't take that time off.
Love it. I love it, man. That was fantastic, everybody. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us. This was great, man. The people loved it, too. I'm seeing all those chats and everything. The people loved it.
I love that.
So it's
thank
so
you
great.
For having me, my guy. Thank you, George.
George and everybody else, thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be back in a couple weeks. You got something for us?
Yes, tell them I'm not as negative as you made me out.
So before we go, I'm going to say this. I worked with 9 head coaches. Love Coach Malone. Love Bizdilic. Love Dan Issel. I mean, I'll go down the list. The best coach I've ever worked with, George Carl. Here's why. He's authentically who he is. And I love that.
I love that.
I'll take that.
All right. Oh, there
I
you go.
I think that was a compliment, but
It was.
He's cheerful. All right, everybody. Thanks so much. Hit the like button on the way out. We'll be back in a couple weeks recapping what's going on with the Denver Nuggets. George Carl had to bite his tongue today, but he's not going to bite it here next time we're in this couch.
Well, they got a week to figure it out.
They got a week to figure it out. We'll see you guys then.